So I thought it would be actually worthwhile to go through an example of a continuous POVM. Just so you, so this is from the notes. This is the SU2 coherent states. So you know that for a particle, we have the regular coherent states, which are basically the Gaussian states or the minimum uncertainty states in L2R. Okay, so the so we'll just make a comment. The regular coherent states are the minimum uncertainty states well in L2Rn, I guess, arbitrary dimensions. And we can develop an analog of these in the case of angular momentum. Okay, so the SU2 coherent states are an analog for angular momentum systems. And so they are minimum uncertainty states. In the sense that, what is it? Something like delta JX, delta JY is greater than or equal to, what is it? H bar over 2 JZ? Sorry, I don't remember this by heart. Did I put that in the notes, actually? Okay, I didn't write this down, but there's some, you can derive some uncertainty principle for angular momentum, which is, I think at most I have the prefactor wrong here. So I'm not sure of the exact form of this rule. So whatever that uncertainty principle is, they're saturated by these SU2 coherent states. So we reach the minimum. Okay, so how do we define them? So let's recall for angular momentum, we have the commutation relations Jx, Jy is equal to I h bar Jz. Was there a factor of 2 in that? I don't have that written down. And cyclic permutations okay, so then we have eigenstates all right, where M obviously goes from minus J to plus J. And so now what we can do is we can define a rotation operator U theta phi, which is an element of SU2. Which is a subset of the unitary group on D dimensions, where D equals 2J plus 1. So the rotation operator U theta phi has the form E to the I, let's use the same convention in the notes, phi JZ over H bar, e to the I theta jx over h bar. So here the angular momentum algebra are the generators of the group action of SU2. And then we can define an arbitrary state theta phi as the action of u theta phi acting on the state jj. So this is the state of maximum polarization along the z direction. And then when we apply this unitary operator, we're taking the state of maximum polarization along z and we're rotating it to some other point on the sphere. Okay, so you have the state of maximum polarization here. This is theta equals 0, phi equals 0. You apply some rotation and it's going to map that vector to some new point on the sphere defined by theta and phi. So you'd have some phi and some theta. Okay, so the collection of states theta phi are the SU2 coherent states. So this is a continuous set, so they're obviously not orthonormal. Okay, because if I do 180 degree rotation, then of course I'm going to get a state that's orthonormal to the up z vector. But if I do a small rotation, then there'll be some non-trivial overlap. In fact, you have, in general, theta prime, phi prime, theta phi. Is equal to the cosine of phi over 2 to the 2j. Let me make this a magnitude. Where this is a capital phi, which should be distinguished from the lowercase phi, and the capital phi is defined implicitly from the arccos. So this shows, so the condition for them to be orthonormal is the condition that cos phi is 0, this capital phi. So this is a definition. Okay, so what's the sense in which I can talk about this state JJ as being a state of maximum polarization? All right, it's that the expectation value of the angular momentum operator is pointing straight up. So if we take the expectation value of J, which is just the expectation value of Jx plus the expectation value of Jy plus the expectation value of Jz, so this is a vector-valued quantity. Okay, so then we can talk about this with respect to the lab frame. This is some vector J. Okay, so for state theta phi, we get exactly theta phi. So the empirical quantity you can observe is the expectation value on repetitions of the measurement, and it's that vector that you obtain through long-run statistics that identifies these angles that parameterize our states. Okay. Where are we? Here? Yeah, well, this is my vector symbol. This vector symbol? Oh, you mean this should be, right, this should be EX, EY, EZ. Thank you. Okay, good. So that's just an interesting set of states that have lots of useful applications. But now the point is we can talk about measuring with respect to this continuous set. Okay, so we can perform a measurement with respect to this continuous set. Of projectors. And in particular, we can encode the idea that this we can encode the idea that we have some finite resolution. Okay, so suppose we can only read out this vector theta phi with some finite precision. What notation do I use here? Let's just call the precision some region B, which is a subset of 0 to 2 pi cross, which one goes 0 to pi? Theta goes 0 to pi, so this is pi 0 to 2 pi. So B is some subinterval on my range of values. So what we can do is we can define an operator EB. So this is now going to be an element of a POVM, so it's a positive operator. And we're going to define it as 2j plus 1 over 4 pi integral over all angles in this subset B, sine theta, d phi, theta phi. So this is some rank 1 projector. This is our invariant measure on the sphere. And this is the region, and this is a normalization factor that's going to guarantee that it's going to guarantee that E of omega is going to be equal to identity, the identity operator, which is one of the conditions we need to have a well-defined POVM, so the probabilities add to 1. And it's pretty obvious that for any B, we have a non-negative operator, because this is a, how's that obvious? Oh, I guess this is a positive measure if you write it as d cos theta d phi. Yeah, this is a measure, right? This is a measure, so this is a non-negative, this is a convex combination of projectors. And then we can talk about the probability of finding the system in the region B, which is a subset of this interval, is equal to trace of EB times rho for input state rho. Where the collection of operators EB is a POVM. Okay. So that gives a kind of a concrete example of continuous outcome measurement. Any questions about that?
Isn't this offset a minus sign?
Where would that be? Here?
Is it d cosine?
Better not be. Sometimes these things, like this is like one of these Jacobian things. So this might be there's an absolute value here we've dropped.
You want the, okay, I'll think about it.
Okay, good. So now we can look at something from Unique. So basically, remember the last class, so we looked at two different ways to construct a generalized measurement. We looked at taking mixtures of the projective measurements, and we saw this idea of doing a projective measurement on a composite system ancilla, and that they both gave rise to a structure of this form, where we have positive operators and sum to identity. So now the question is any mathematical object of this form, not that form specifically, but recall my definition of a POVM, is any mathematical object that's a POVM something you can realize in the lab, first of all, and second of all, it's something we can express in terms of our original ideal postulates? So the answer to that question is yes, and I'll show that now. But first, there's a question.
I wanted to know, how do you actually calculate that trace? You just put it rho inside the integral there, and you just compress it with both?
Yeah, what's going to happen is you're going to have this object, and you can use this trick where for any fixed data phi, I choose some orthomorphic basis to evaluate the trace. So then I'm going to get an expression of the form, theta phi,
I wrote it.
Theta phi, and I'll be integrating against that. Yes?
Is it easy to see that E of omega is identity?
Well, it's easy if you use an identity. So I don't know how hard it is to prove this identity.
But
you have a resolution of unity, which is the identity operator is equal to 2j plus 1 over 4 pi. I don't remember how hard it is to prove this.
This is the addition theorem for spherical harmonics, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
For spherical harmonics.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is that right? Okay. Yeah, I don't think about it. But I meant to give you guys that anyways. All right. So what we're going to need to establish this result is Nymark's violation theorem.
Omega is the whole set. So basically, omega here is the
So the idea of this is that for any POVM, which is a set of operators E, and for any state rho, which is an element of the linear operators on AJ, there exists a PVM. So this is an orthogonal collection of projectors acting on a Hilbert space HA tensor HB. And there exists an input state phi, which is an element of HB, such that the Born rule probability of x, which is equal to trace as ex rho, where remember x is some element of the sigma algebra, so it's some measurable set on our subset of our continuous set, that this can be realized by a dilation as the trace of rho tensor phi against the PVM element. And this is true for any x and f. Where this is a PVM element in the sense of von Neumann's projector value measure. Okay, so what's the significance of this? Well, as I mentioned, it's the fact that we can always think about anything that's a POVM. There's a kind of derisive phrase for this, which is called the church of the larger Hilbert space. So people say, well, look, rather than think about this POVM element as my primitive, I'm just going to cash it out in terms of my ideal primitives, which are projectors, acting on a larger space. So that's the church of the larger Hilbert space. Ironically, it's a move that's common for people to think about pure states as physical. Because if you think about pure states as physical, then you want to express everything in terms of your physical primitives. So it typically goes that type of, I guess commonly, this is a natural move for people who have that position. But I think it's a natural move for other reasons, which are some of the ones we discussed last class, which is that the POVM is a very provisional representation of the kinds of measurements you can do. And I'll explain that more a little bit later. But there's an even stronger way to think about this result. Which is that, moreover, P of X can always be realized via von Neumann's indirect measurement. Means that we can think of P of X as, all right, so my system Hilbert space is first. We can think of P of X as U dagger identity on A enter some projector pi of X U. Where the key point here is that pi of X, pi is a linear operator on AB. Okay, so we can substitute that into here, which means that any POVM, any mathematical object you write down that's a POVM, I can realize in the lab. So, you know, the simple, so the point is when we start with this picture, which is I have some input, I have some measurement device, this is my knob, this is my pointer. So I get some outcome, and the idea is that I'm representing this by some POVM, E. Well, let's think of it, let's make it discrete. Let's look at the discrete case. Okay, so this is now the POVM EK, so the probability of K is equal to the trace of EK rho. So what we're saying here is that we start with this and we can model it, we can always realize it via what's inside the box now is that we have our input state rho, we have this ancilla here. We're gonna apply some unitary, and then we're gonna apply some measurement here, which is modeled by some pi k. We get our output state. So instead of thinking of the raw measurement in terms of this POVM, so now what's inside the box this piece. Okay, so that fits in there. Okay, so the fact that we considered these two scenarios for generalized measurement, they gave us this POVM structure, and now we see that any POVM can be realized via a model of this form. We come up with a kind of a provisional postulate. For measurement, we call it realistic measurement. And we'll just give it in terms of the discrete case for simplicity. So here this is just rehashing a bit, but the point is the most general measurement on the system is represented by a POVM where our generalized Bohm rule is that the probability of outcome mu is equal to the trace of rho d mu. Okay, so we saw previously that if we do a measurement this way, we induce a POVM on the system. Now we're showing that if we do a POVM on the system, we can always think of it as being realized this way. But why am I underscoring that this is a provisional postulate? What kind of procedure can I do in the lab that won't be represented by a POVM? This ties in with what you were asking. Okay, we assume that the input state of the ancilla was uncorrelated with the input state of the system. So if you're in the either unusual or unfortunate situation, there's some degrees of freedom for apparatus that are, because of, say, some noise mechanism, correlated with the state you're trying to measure, and that induces a nonlinearity, in fact, in the system. So quantum mechanics is linear in general, even the generalized version, the realistic version, except when you have these input correlations.
But can't you then go to a larger space, do the same thing, and have non-correlation again?
Yeah, the assumption is that we can always do that. But remember the goal here is that we want to talk about some particular degree of freedom, like a spin half particle, or the position of a particle, you know, or angular momentum of space dimension 2j plus 1. And what we want, in terms of these realistic postulates, is a set of a mathematical characterization of that system in terms of operators on the Hilbert space of the system. So we can certainly always dilate everything and get rid of those things by going sufficiently back in the past, we assume, or sufficiently out in space to include everything that's relevant. The problem is, in terms of our ability to model this as action on the system alone, we're limited. And we have to exclude those scenarios. And this is a subtle point which is not well known. So people don't really appreciate that. It's only now that the community is starting to struggle with the fact that, you know, this, you know, the 15 years people were thinking about characterizing quantum mechanics in terms of POVMs, completely positive maps, which we'll see next. But now people are starting to appreciate that that's not, more general things can happen. And that's coming back to this point. This is one of the reasons why I kind of think that the Church of the Larger Hilbert Space is the right way to think about quantum mechanics from a fundamental point of view, because that's the only way we get a self-consistent representation of the theory. If you try and describe everything on the system alone, then initial correlations like that give you a non-self-consistent description of what can happen. In the notes, I have another example of a POVM, which is simpler. It's this trine measurement or the Mercedes-Benz measurement, where you have a two-level system and you consider the non-orthogonal projectors associated with these three directions separated by 120 degrees. I think that this is part of a an exercise that Aggie gave you for homework, where she asks you to show that this measurement gives you operational capabilities that aren't available if you just do projective measurements. So let me just underscore the conceptual message here, and then I'll leave you to the technical details of your homework. Simple POVM, all the trines. Okay, so it's these three projectors. And the point is that if I'm playing some kind of game where my challenge is to guess which state you prepared, and I'm going to do some measurement, and I want to have my best ability to guess correctly, I want to have the optimal probability of success. The question is, well, what measurement do I do? Well, it's going to depend on what the input states are. But you can show that there are, your promise is going to be one of two or three states, and under that promise, you can show that the best measurement you can do is this trine measurement, which is not a PVM. Okay, it's not a projected measurement, because these projectors are not orthogonal. So it turns out you can Nymark dilate this. You can Nymark dilate this and realize it via von Neumann's indirect measurement. So you use a scheme like this to show, well, what do I have to do in the lab to actually make this measurement? So here, let me be a little bit more precise here, which is the point of these. You have each of these vectors are called, this is chi0, chi1, chi2, and then e sub nu is equal to chi nu, rescaled by some factor, which is 2/3. So it's not a projector because it has this factor in front of it, and they're not orthogonal because they're separated by 120 degrees. So what the message I want to tell you here is that, look, with access to this POVM, I can do a better job of distinguishing certain input states. So that's an advantage, because we're limiting ourselves to a single-shot measurement. Right? I'm not repeating the experiment 1,000 times and collecting statistics, doing tomography to find out what the input state is. I'm given one copy of the system, so I'm only going to get one measurement outcome. I'm not going to get Born-Rule statistics. So with that one measurement outcome, how confident can I be about which state was prepared? And then doing this measurement is the optimal one for this particular pair of states. So the question is, why is it better? Why is it better than a PVM measurement? Well, it's because you're bringing in other quantum resources. Because if you're doing that in the lab, you're doing something like this, which means you're giving yourself access to this Ancilla system, and you have coherent control over both systems. So this is, kind of an impressive experimental capability to do that. With today's technology, and so you're able to do a better job of distinguishing the input states because you're giving yourself access to more quantum resources, right? Since the dimension of the Hilbert space you control is bigger, so that's kind of the conceptual sense in which you gain this advantage. Okay, so just kind of as a bit of an interesting side example of a POVM, I'll tell you a little about the mutually unbiased bases. They're something that come up quite a bit. They're combinatorial, they're very interesting, and people study them for lots of reasons, including tomography. So this is just another example of a POVM. So the mutually unbiased bases are a generalization of in wave mechanics we have position and momentum, and the eigenstates, even though they're not in the Hilbert space, they all have the same inner product. So the question is there an analog of this in finite dimensions? So the idea of mutually unbiased is that we have some collection of bases. Okay, so here the point is that runs from 0 to m. So this refers to a basis. It's an index for the basis. And then A runs from 0 to D minus 1. So here we're dealing with a Hilbert space, which is D-dimensional. So A refers to the element of the basis. A is the element of basis B. Okay, so this set of objects here, if we keep B fixed, then we have a normal basis. If we keep A fixed and B varies, then we have different elements of two different bases. The key point, the unbiasedness condition, is that we want the inner products. We want the inner products to satisfy if any two elements from distinct bases, then we want them to have a fixed inner product, which is one of the square root of the dimension. And then of course if they're elements of the same basis, then it's 0, assuming A is not equal to A. Okay, so the maximum number of mutually unbiased bases you can have is 2 plus 1. And so Smicks and combinatorics that come into just talking about constructing these, and they're known to exist in all dimensions which are a power of a prime. Okay, maximum set. Construct the POVM from these objects. So what we're going to do is we need to rescale the projectors. So for each B and A, we define a positive operator as psi A, psi B. Okay, so why do this? Because this POVM is called topographically complete. Okay, so it's easy to check that this satisfies a POVM condition. It basically means if we sum over A and B, we get identity. But this POVM is what's called topographically complete. What that means is, given the statistics, probability of AB equal to the trace of EAB rho for every AB. I can reconstruct the state. discretely determine or parameterize the unknown input state row. All right, so maybe this is a question you've never thought of before, but if I give you a density operator, how do you ever find out, if I give you a system, how do you ever find out how I prepared it? Remember, row describes the preparation of the system. And so the question is, there's this physical system, how did I actually prepare it? Well, row, whether it's a pure state or a mixed state, is a description of how I prepared the system. And it's in general a D by D matrix. And so we need to determine all of the parameters of row. So right, so we know that if row is an element of the linear operator is on some d-dimensional Hilbert space, well, we know that we have d diagonal entries that are real. Well, in fact, they're non-negative. Real and sum to one by the trace. Okay, so that implies we have d minus one parameters here. And we also have d times d minus one over two off diagonal elements. So these are complex parameters, complex numbers. Off diagonal. All right, so let's draw this out. We have a total number of parameters d minus 1 plus d times d minus 1 over 2, and they're complex, so I multiply by 2, which gives me d minus 1 plus d squared minus d, which is equal to d squared minus 1. So that's the number of real numbers needed to characterize an arbitrary preparation. Okay, if you happen to have a promise that it's a pure state, it'll be less. So you realize that if I just measure a PVM in some basis, I'm not going to get, what am I going to get? I'm going to get D minus 1 numbers if I have a set of rank 1 projectors. So that's obviously deficient. You need to measure in more than one basis to measure the off-diagonal terms. So for a qubit on the block sphere, it's easy. You measure Z, you measure X, you measure Y. You completely characterize where the vector is in the block sphere. How do you do that in general for an arbitrary dimensional system? Well, one approach is the MUV. These MUVs, you construct a POVM out of them, and then the statistics you get are topographically complete. So you can see this from parameter counting. So for the MUV POVM, we have D plus one probability vectors induced by measuring the basis, right? So what I mean here is if I fix B and I run over A, that gives me a projective measurement in the basis B. So that's going to give me D minus 1 components, D minus 1 probabilities, or independent numbers. So I have D plus 1 bases. Each basis gives me D minus 1 parameters. Because of normalization for each projector, we lose one degree of freedom. So that gives d squared minus 1 numbers. Now, what I haven't proven to you here, so clearly, if I measure in one fixed basis, by normalization, I'm only getting D minus one outcomes and they're independent. But what I haven't shown you is that from each basis of the MUV, I'm getting independent information. Because I could get redundant information, in which case, even though I've gotten D squared minus one numbers out, some of them might be redundant information, and so I'm not getting the full set of independent parameters. So, you know, with some effort, you can go ahead and prove that they are in fact independent. So that's another application. I think I saw in Abby's homework or tutorial, she introduces you to the seek POVM, the symmetric informationally complete POVM. Does that sound familiar? Maybe that's forthcoming. Anyways, that's another approach to building a tomographically complete measurement. Any questions about this? Start with you.
I can't. Well, like everything written down the board is really the statement, so I cannot really feel I understand the stuff. Like especially why the people define the unbiased basis in that building. The overlap is 1/√2.
Why 1/√d? Well, I guess there's two questions here. One, why do we want it to be a constant? And then why is that constant 1/√d? So the reason for being constant is the notion of mutually unbiased. So you want, I want a geometrically symmetric condition where any element of the first basis has the point, okay, the inner product is like an angle. Okay, so this is essentially an angle in Hilbert space. Okay. So what you want is you want the angles between, pick some basis b equals 0. Now I want to construct a new basis where the angle between any vector in my first basis and any vector in my second basis is the same, which suggests that they're kind of evenly distributed in the geometric space. So that's the kind of geometric or mathematical ideal here. And then the kind of conceptual assumption is that by measuring with respect to sets of bases which are unbiased in this way, I'm getting some kind of optimal approach to estimating the vector. I'm trying to estimate a vector in some sense. And to estimate that vector, I want to measure with respect to a set of bases which give me the best information. So if I made two projective measurements and they were almost parallel to each other, then I'm not going to get very independent information. I want the second measurement to be kind of as different as possible from the first one. So that's the kind of intuition behind it. And then the reason that it's 1/√d is just that that's the only possibility to construct such things. And the analog is with the classical situation where we have the position eigenstates and the momentum eigenstates. And they're unbiased in the sense that xp is equal to e to the I kx equal to k. For every k, excuse me, and x. Yeah, I'm just trying to think, is there even a better way to answer this? Yeah, I think that's, did that help? I mean, I'm not quite sure.
So the definition of the bias mean that we put the absolute value in an equal
value.
Yeah,
so it's true.
I was wondering what is the definition of the bias. So you say that x and k, if we do the inner product and then become e to the power I kx, and you call it bias. So it doesn't mean that we put absolute value for
absolute value equals to 1.
I mean the bias.
Why is this called?
Yeah,
this case is on dimension.
I mean, look.
You want the opposite of sign.
Look, I mean, the idea is that if I have two vectors which are orthogonal, so remember in Hilbert space and the Bloch sphere, these are orthogonal. All right, so in Cartesian space, orthogonal means 90 degrees, but here 180 degrees means orthogonal. Right. So point is, if I introduce a new vector here, then it's closer to this vector than it is to that vector. Right. So this angle is smaller, the inner product is bigger between this vector and this guy, and between this vector and this guy. These are elements of a basis. So the question is, can I construct a new basis? Every element of that new basis, I want to put it at an angle so that it's at the same angle with respect to the elements of the first basis. So what's unbiased here is that the new basis element has the same angle or the same inner product with respect to every element of the old basis. Okay, so for the case of the qubit, we have z up, z down. These are orthogonal. This is my first basis. And then I have x up, x down. And notice that the angles between x up and x down are the same with both z up and z down. All right, so the MUV for a qubit is literally just the three, you know, there's d equals 2. So the number of MUVs is d plus 1, which is 3. And it's exactly the three Cartesian bases. Right, it's kind of you can do classical mechanics with the basis that's not orthogonal, but it's awkward, right? You lose a lot of the nice properties if you don't use an orthogonal basis. So now, in Hilbert space, which is a more complex geometric space, it's higher dimensional, we can visualize it. We can ask, well, given one basis, which has now d elements, can I construct a new basis where every element of that new basis has the same inner product with every element of the old basis? And then you say, okay, can I do that now? Now the answer is yes. And then I say, well, can I do it again? Can I construct a third basis which has the same inner product with every element of the first basis, so it's mutually unbiased there. And it's also mutually unbiased with respect to every element of the second basis. So it's not obvious you can do that, right? And then the question is, well, when can you do that? What is a maximal set? A maximal set is d plus one such bases. You can never have more than that. When is it possible? Not always. It turns out for Hilbert space d equals 6, it's impossible to construct a maximal set of MUVs. So it's only in certain dimensions we can do this. It's a very kind of highly symmetric geometric object because of this interpretation in terms of angles. And it turns out it has practical applications. So, you know, people like things that just are geometrically interesting because they have high symmetry, and this is one of those objects, so it's a purely mathematical reason to be interested in it. And then from a practical point of view of tomography, it's also very relevant. It turns out you can prove that it's optimal for certain, in terms of the number of statistics we need to collect to do state estimation. I hope that helped a bit. Did you have a follow-up question?
Yeah, actually it's almost the same, but like, why we are not using orthogonal basis? Like we have non-zero overlap between the different beams. So why there's overlap is necessary? To do holographically
beat
method.
Each basis is orthogonal.
Yeah. Each basis is orthogonal.
Yeah, you should have like a one for b equals b prime and a equals a prime there as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, then it's the same vector.
So it's one.
Yeah.
So then that has to be
yeah.
Well, that means my states are normalized.
Yep.
Yeah. So I'm assuming I have normalized states.
But if the two write down that, like, if E and B prime is not equal, like, the contraction is not zero.
It's
not
zero.
Yeah, right. So I'm asking, like, even though it is different basis, like, why we are using the basis that, like,
sorry, okay, think about this. So here, let's look, z is b equals 0, x is b equals 1, y is b equals 2. So now, if I have, this is a equals 0, this is a equals 1. So they're orthogonal. Remember, orthogonality is anti-parallel. Then b, now let's consider a new basis. Each element of this basis this inner product, the eigenstates of x, so if I have my poly x operator, and I have my poly z operator, okay, so this is the z upstate and this is the x upstate. What's their inner product? It's not zero, right? It's one over square root of two. Where d equals two. Okay, so that's what we're trying to build. We're trying to build this structure in a larger dimensional Hilbert space. So in the same, so we kind of, okay, so now maybe we have a better intuitive answer. Why do you want to use x, y, and z as a set of bases for the block sphere? Well, because they're a natural orthogonal set, right? Orthogonal, what I'm saying, it's orthogonal in Cartesian space, but in Hilbert space, they're not orthogonal, right? This is not orthogonal. So the right way to think of orthogonality here is mutually unbiased. So maybe that's, I think part of the intuition problem is that what we view as orthogonal when we draw this picture is not orthogonal. It's an unbiased inner product. So that's what's being generalized. There's another question, yeah.
So like here you mentioned that the maximum number of such bases is d plus one, but it's not always true. So in that case, this not true, then this set is not homographic, right?
If, like, in six, in dimension six.
Yeah. So it's not homographic.
So what I hopefully said, a maximal set. Okay, so, yes, for a maximal set.
And the other question is that suppose we are in the like prime number power dimensions, example 9. So in that case, like even though we don't choose it to be like mutually unbiased spaces, for example, we don't choose it to be 1 over square root d, is it still a tomographic complete
base?
No,
it would be 1 over square root d.
But like we make it to be something like, oh, we intended to choose a basis such that it's not 1 over square root d. Like, can it still achieve the like homographic completeness?
Yes.
So here the reason why we choose it to be 1 over square root of d is just to make it symmetric.
Yeah, but it's to make it symmetric, but there's a reason for making it symmetric. Okay, so basically, if you're suppose let's just go to regular Cartesian space. Okay, so R3. X3 of the circle. Draw it as. And now I want you to estimate a vector. So it's a probability vector. So we're going to repeat statistics each time we get outcome along one of these axes. We collect statistics and we can estimate this probability vector.
Yeah.
Now if you decide to estimate this probability vector, if you only measure the z components, you only know the z projection.
Yeah.
And so, you know, to estimate a probability, you have to repeat some number of times n, and your statistical estimate goes as 1 over square root of n. There's no repetitions. Now, suppose that you're like, okay, well, instead of measuring z, x, and y, I'm just going to choose whatever basis I like.
Yeah.
Forget about the symmetry. And so you measure along an axis z prime, which is some small angle with respect to z, and you realize that's not going to give me complete information. I need three, that just defines a plane now. Z and Z prime define a plane. This is a three-dimensional vector. So now I pick some other vector, Z double prime, and I estimate along that direction. Now I can't prove this to you, but I'm certain it's right. So the point is that if you do that, and then your friend next to you uses Z, X, and Y, she will get a better statistical estimate of the vector with the same number of samples than you will.
Yeah.
Because you're getting information that's very redundant.
Yeah.
And so to get a really good reading of the components orthogonal to Z, you're not going to get a good estimate of those. To get a good estimate, you want to kind of have your measurements be maximally spread out, as allowed by the geometry of the space. So that's the advantage of the symmetry, is you want them to be maximally spread out. And so that's what this condition is doing. I want the next basis to be as kind of spread out from the first basis as possible. So that's the kind of conceptual insight. Okay, good, that was great. I'm glad that you guys pushed for more detail there. Okay, we're going to use the same approach as previously. Okay, so the first step is we're going to consider probabilistic mixtures. We're going to consider the reduced action. Hilbert space HA given some mu, which is a unitary acting on HA HB. Okay, so the unitary acting on a composite system, we want to find what's the effective transformation that occurs only on the Hilbert space of some system of interest. Okay, so case one, we're just going to construct an object lambda acting on rho, which is going to be a sum over L, EL, UL, rho, EL. And then we're going to realize we can introduce, this is completely trivial, we're going to introduce operators AL, which are going to be the square root of EL times UL, which is absorbing this coefficient, and then we can write the map as sum over L, AL rho, AL dagger. And we remark that to preserve normalization of the state, so we want to call this rho prime. We want trace of rho prime equal to trace of rho. So we're going to demand this, and that's going to tell us that the sum over L AL dagger AL equal to the identity. All right, and then in case two, which is a little bit less trivial, we're going to have some system, rho A is equal to lambda, this is rho A prime. So we want this effective description, and we know what's actually happening is that we have, some output state, rho A B prime. It's obtained from some unitary transformation on rho A tensor with some row B, your dagger. So we know that row A prime is going to be given by the partial trace of row AB prime. So what we want to do is take the partial trace of that. So that means that lambda row A is equal to the partial trace over B of U row A tensor row B dagger. Here, just okay, for simplicity of notation. So for ease of notation, let's just assume that row B is a pure state. Just call it zero. Okay, where zero is obviously any state. Okay, then what we can do is we can introduce some operator. We're going to introduce an operator kk, which is equal to k u0. Okay, getting ahead of myself, let me expand this partial trace out. So how do we evaluate the partial trace? Sum over a basis for the other system. So we want lambda row A, we're going to sum over some basis K for the Hilbert space of the other system. And here we assume this was zero. So we can write this as K U zero row A zero dagger K. And then we can easily check that it follows that we have the condition sum over k, kk dagger ak is equal to identity if the trace of row ab prime is equal to the trace of row ab. All right, so if this transformation preserves normalization, then we get this constraint. And we put no other constraints on the operators AK. They're arbitrary linear operators. Yes?
What is the U of L? Like their subscript L? Like
here?
Yeah.
Think of it as super operational picture. So we have the box that spits out the state, spits out the system, I should say. The system goes into a transformation box. Now the transformation box applies a unitary. That was our postulate.
So is the U of L living in the linear L of each A?
Oh yeah, sorry. One of the mathematical answer. Well, here I just have one Hilbert space, right? So just H. I haven't talked about another Hilbert. There's only one Hilbert space here. So rho is a linear operator in H, and UL is a linear operator in H. So there's only one Hilbert space. You can call it HA or you can call it H. Now in this situation, the subscript A means that of course it's in Hilbert space A. So here, this U here, I should specify, this U is a linear operator in HA tensor HB. Okay, so I said that in words, that it's a unitary acting on the larger Hilbert space. So this corresponds to a situation where you have two systems, you have some unitary, and then what you do is this one goes into the garbage, and then you're only interested in describing this system. This is B. And you want to rep, because you, I mean, think of it this way. I have a system that's evolving. So now this is an example of decoherence. Okay, so I have my system. It's supposed to be a free particle, nothing's supposed to happen to it, but it scatters off the dust particle. I didn't know the dust particle was there, I don't know what happens to the dust particle, So this is the dust particle. This represents the scattering process. I don't observe the dust particle later, so I trace it out. When you trace things out is when you know nothing about them. And then that gives me an effective description of the dynamics, and that effective description has this form. And notice that I'm preserving the trace here, but for both situation one and situation two, in general, you lose purity. Trace of rho A squared is going to be less than or equal to the trace of rho A, which means that I've lost purity, which means I've lost information. Okay, so a good way to think about pure states is the following. If my quantum system is described by a pure state, that means there's at least one projective measurement whose outcome I can predict with certainty. So that's the ideal situation. Because of the uncertainty principle, there's going to be more than one measurement, and I won't be able to predict all of them. But if the state is pure, then there's at least one measurement I can do where I can predict with certainty the outcome. If the state is mixed, there is no such measurement. So I'm losing information. And that's represented by this purity quantity here. And so both of these situations, one and two, give rise to what's called decoherence. I lose information about the system. I'll have less signal on my measurement. And so I either get it because I'm putting it through a box, and what that box does changes each time, although the unitary each time is different. Or the box represents some process, some interaction, which usually is undesired. And because of that undesired interaction, okay, so this is an example of decoherence. Decoherence. Sorry, my handwriting is sloppy here. Through unwanted interaction. Just an example. Yeah. Sorry, I wrote this really lousily. This is an example of decoherence through unwanted interactions. Okay, which is a pretty important concept, so now finally you see kind of two ways it can arise. They're both examples of it, in fact, but the second case is more of the canonical idea of decoherence. Some people call the first case incoherence. Incoherence or dephasing are examples. And here, this is a canonical example of decoherence. Okay, but the word decoherence generally refers to both of these, and sometimes people mean specifically this, so the terminology is fixed. Yeah?
I don't get really what the definition of coherence and decoherence, what is going on in the other. Is it loss of purity?
Well, coherence is a noun and decoherence is a verb. So it's the first distinction.
What
no,
anything?
Coherence is a noun.
Huh?
Anyway.
Decoherence is a noun, but it's used as a verb. So decoherence is a process and coherence is a property.
So what is a coherent state?
Okay, so a coherent state is a different use of the word coherent. Coherence means lots of things, depending on who you're talking to. Okay, so a coherent state. Okay, so coherence and coherent state refers to the minimum uncertainty definitions. We talk about a coherent state. What people usually mean is the definition one is a minimum uncertainty state. If people talk about a state having coherence, a state that is coherent, then they don't mean it's necessarily a minimum uncertainty state. They mean just a state where it's not diagonal. So rho for that state is not diagonal. Well, sorry, rho is always diagonalizable. Is not diagonal in a particular base. Sorry, is net diagonal in a specific basis. So it's a basis dependent notion. Or they can mean that it's just not fully mixed. Basically, we'll all talk about coherence in a basis. So it's coherent with respect to those. So for example, if I have a state psi equals alpha 0 plus beta 1, all right, then that's a coherent superposition of 0 and 1. So we would say this state is coherent. It's not diagonal in the 0, 1 basis. But of course, if alpha equals 1 over square root of 2, and beta equals 1 over square root of 2, then psi is equal to the plus 1 eigenstate of sigma x.
Yeah.
So it's not, it is diagonal in the x basis.
Right.
It's diagonal in the x basis because it's a pure eigenstate of x. But it's the same state as this. I'm just using a different basis to describe it. So in this basis, it has off-diagonal elements, and in this basis, it does not. So the objective property of the state is that it's pure. And when we talk about whether it's coherent, whether it has off-diagonal elements in a particular basis or not, we're making a basis-specific statement. But people are sloppy, and that's what they say.
But it's coherent. A coherent state, then the first one that you give a minimum uncertainty state, you mean like a state which has zero, like zero entropy, or what is that pure state?
A pure state is a state with zero entropy. Coherent state is a special case of zero entropy states. A coherent state is a particular state that satisfies the uncertainty principle. I mean, they all satisfy the uncertainty. It saturates the uncertainty principle.
So it has zero entropy, but it's not pure.
Yeah, so a coherent state psi. So a coherent state psi, which is typically denoted alpha, has the property that delta x, delta p is equal to a star over 2. So that's this notion. That's not true of all states, right? There are pure states which aren't minimum uncertainty. So, I mean, let me give you an example of a coherent state that's not minimum uncertainty. Okay, a coherent state has the form, let me call it psi alpha is equal to e to the I px e to the x minus x bar squared over sigma squared.
Yep.
All right, so this state with some normalization factor, it's going to saturate the uncertainty principle. So it's a pure state. It's coherent in the sense of definition 2, but it's also coherent in the sense of definition 1 because it saturates the uncertainty principle.
So not all pure states.
No.
Satisfy.
Now consider this state. Consider a coherent superposition of two coherent states. Right? So this is, you have a e to the I px e to the minus x bar 1 squared over 2 sigma squared plus, so I shouldn't write this as a cap function of x, plus b e to the I px e to the minus x 2 bar squared over 2 sigma squared. So this is also called a cat state. So this is called a cat state because it's a coherent superposition of the particle being localized around x1 plus it being localized around x2. So the probability distribution of finding the particle at some position x is going to look like this. Oh, we have a bimodal probability distribution described by this situation. So this is a coherent superposition of coherent states, which is not a coherent state. Right? So this is not a coherent state. sorry, I forgot kind of how confusing this is. So the word coherent means different things, all right? So that's coherent. Now decoherence refers to exactly the fact that you start with some input state rho A, you evolve in time, your final state rho A prime is less pure. Right, this is decoherence. So why is it coherent with respect to this? Because a state that is coherent is a state that's not fully mixed. So you can talk about degrees of coherence, which is how far away are you from being fully mixed, right? So a decoherence is a process, and it's a verb when you say you decohere the system, when you're moving it closer to fully mixed. So you're reducing the amount of coherence.
And incoherence?
So incoherence is when you do that, but specifically via a mixture of unitaries. But not everyone will use that definition. So here's the problem. You had people in the NMR community that were studying how to coherently control nuclear spins. You had people in the atomic optics community that were studying how to coherently control atoms interacting with fields. For example, you put an atom in a cavity, the cavity QED. Those two communities were essentially independent communities. Nobody talked to each other. But they were both doing exactly the same quantum mechanics. And they came up with their own terminology. So for example, in NMR, what's called decoherence is called dephasing in the AMO community. And then what happened is quantum information came along. And of course, all these people realized they would get grant money if they did quantum information experiments and went to the same conferences. And they started realizing, hey, we have different words, same words mean different things. So now with quantum information in the past 15 years, you're starting to see the language normalize. And now there's a kind of a standard set of terms, but that process hasn't completely completed itself. So you have to deal a bit with different notations and different terminologies. Yes.
Like in case of second case, like rho B behaves like rho environment, but like here we assume that it is pure. But like can we do the similar thing if like rho B is mixed?
Yeah. So yeah, that's a good question. Okay, so I simplified my life by assuming rho B was pure. So first step one, what do you remember from the purification of the mixed state? I can always take a mixed state rho b. I didn't tell you the dimension of the Hilbert space HB, right? So I can just dilate the dimension, and then whatever mixed state I have will be a pure state in that bigger Hilbert space. That's the Hilbert space I'm talking about. So that's, in some sense, assuming the state is pure, is completely general because of the purification theorem. I haven't bounded the dimension of HB. But if I want to fix the dimension of HB and talk about mixed states in HB, then I can always write any mixed state rho B can always be written as a mixture PL and set of states L, right? That's always possible. That's just going to introduce an additional sum here. You know, now a sum over L. LL. And now I just define AK comma L, AK to be this. Okay, how easy is this? I'm worried about my definition of AK. I'm going to have these L's sticking around. Okay, I'm missing something really simple here. This isn't hard. You guys have to have a double sum. All right, I can't get rid of the sum. So I'll define AKL to be this. All right, and then I just sum over KL. Now I just have a double index. So it's working. Double index continues through. So while I have your attention on this, and we kind of this is all fresh in your minds, and I'm sorry to stand between you and your lunch, let me tell you another interesting conceptual point. Notice the similarity between this picture and measurement. Okay, so in measurement, we have this picture, but instead of putting this in the garbage can, we did a measurement. And we got information came out. Info came out, which basically means that someone's eyeball was here and they saw what happens with this other particle. They got a piece of information about that particle. Then for this person who sees what happened, what's taking place is a measurement. For someone else who's over here,
big eyeball.
For someone else who's over here and is looking at this system and doesn't know about this system, decoherence has happened. So we have two different observers, two different interpretations of what's happened. This person is going to assign a mixed state and will have lost its coherent description. And this person will assign a pure state if the measurement was good enough. And so she will not have lost coherence. So this, again, reinforces this idea that quantum states are not properties of the system, but descriptions of observers about how the system was prepared. Okay, it's a very important conceptual point, and this is another example of how you get clarity by keeping that in mind. Okay, so in a sense, people talk about decoherence from measurement. What they mean is specifically, you do a measurement and you disregard the outcome, which is the same as putting it in the trash, in which case you don't get this information and you've gotten decoherence. Okay? Okay, great. Thanks for all the great questions today, and we'll see you tomorrow.